It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I know that the internet has changed business and media and dating and a million other things. I had not considered how the internet can change the dictionary. My guest is Merriam-Webster's editor-at-large, Peter Sokolowski. Welcome, Peter.
How are you?
Good, thank you. What do you learn from our Google searches as a lexicographer?
Well, what we really learn is from the searches on our online dictionary at Merriam-Webster.com. So when people look up words, we see in real time what they're looking up. So the fact is, just as with any other kind of search, we have an engine and we have a way of monitoring the data that the data represents the dictionary. The dictionary is a very long tail. It's a long list of words, but we can simplify it and simply make it the head words that we look at in real time to show which words are being looked up. And because the online dictionary is there for your use and it's there for free, it's used by a lot of people. We have 100 million words looked up a month. From that we can derive that, for example, yesterday the number one search was cancel from the story about Roseanne. And the number two search was abhorrent from the ABC statement. So we know that these are the kinds of questions people are asking the dictionary, and we have answers. I think, for example, with cancel, the question might be, does it have one L or two?
And I saw that you tweeted about this. Merriam-Webster tweeted, canceled with one L and canceled with two L's are both standard variants.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in American English, and we actually hearken back to Noah Webster himself, back in 1828 when he wrote his great American Dictionary of the English Language, he wanted to make a break from British English, and he established some of the spellings that we associate with American English today. So, for example, we spell the word color without the letter U today. Mm-hmm. In American English, we dropped the K from public and music. We spell center and theater with an ER rather than an RE. But another thing that Webster hated was silent letters and double letters. And that's the reason that in standard American English, traditionally, a word like canceled or cancellation would have one L rather than two.
Well, either way, Roseanne Barr shows off the air, however you spell it. And abhorrent, that's because ABC talked about her racist comments and people wanted to know, what does abhorrent mean?
Sure, exactly. And they may want to know how to pronounce it. They may want to know its origin. I mean, we're good at reading data. We're not good at reading minds. But it is true that when a word is used in the news like this, I think it was a one-sentence press release that ABC put out, and it was highly commented upon, obviously. And in a way, we're kind of triangulating the news. We're not necessarily reporting the most cogent or important word of the story. We're reporting the word that sent more people to the dictionary,
right?
And that does in this case it corresponds to the big story, but it may not be the most important word, or if you had to summarize that story, it may not be that one word. It's just the word that sent people to look it up.
Peter Sokolowski is on the Word Beat as the editor at large at Merriam-Webster, and we're talking about searches, online searches at Merriam-Webster, and what they can tell us about what's coming to the dictionary. You were telling us about an emerging term I'd never heard of called thirst trap. What is a thirst trap?
Well, thirst trap, you know, the word thirst and the word hunger, for example, those are two of the most basic sort of human qualities. I mean, these are terms that go back they're as old as the English language. But thirst trap is new. This is for social media. It's for Instagram. And thirst trap essentially means a photo that is sort of posted that is intended to attract either likes or attention or desire, and they're typically really sexy photos, kind of made for selfie culture, a photo that's made to entice a response, usually in the form of praise.
But what's a trap about it?
Well, the thing is, because it is, well, it's attracting a fly trap or something. Attracting your attention. It's catching your eye in your feed.
Like bait, clickbait.
It's absolutely parallel to clickbait. Absolutely.
Got it. What does a word have to have on its resume to make it into the dictionary these days?
Well, we usually say, in fact, it hasn't changed. Those criteria are pretty much the same. They need to have widespread use, so it has to be used by lots of people in lots of different publications or lots of different places. It has to be have long-term use. We have to see that it is established and likely to stick around. We want a word that is going to stay in the language and not one that we would maybe have to drop later, or is just a trendy slang term that might go away in a season or two.
But that's your educated guess, right?
These are educated. You can never know for sure. Yeah. That's absolutely true. And that's why, you know, the dictionaries are interesting to look at over time. If you pick up a dictionary from the 1930s, for example, you're likely to see words that maybe that might sound like the way they talked in old movies on the one hand, but you might also see words that you've never even encountered before because they have come and gone. And that's always sort of the gamble. The fact is, though, if a word is used frequently in movies, in books, in newspapers, then it really should be in the dictionary because, say, you're looking at a movie from the 30s in 2018, you should find that word in the dictionary if you need it.
Well, is there a word that some people have trouble with your guess as to whether it's widespread enough or has staying power enough?
Most people like seeing words in the dictionary. What we hear from as complaints are when words aren't yet entered in the dictionary. And we try hard to keep up with the language. It's always changing, always evolving. But for the most part, once in a while, people will complain and say, you know, if you removed this, for example, this offensive word, this swear word or something, then people wouldn't use it. And we have to say, sorry, that's really not the way the word or the language works. We are reflecting the language, but kind of in a rear view mirror. We're kind of a lag indicator, if you were to look at it in financial terms. Because we can only report on the facts, just like journalists do. And the facts are the printed page or the writing online. And so when we report on a word, when we add it to the dictionary, we've got lots of evidence to back it up, and we know it's going to be a perfectly valid word for a long time.
We asked our listeners some of the words they've been looking up, one of which also came from the internet. This is Leonore from Olympia, who learned this one just a few weeks ago.
On Mother's Day this year, my younger son gave me a beautiful black mug with gold letters, gold words on it. And the words said, "So on fleek." Because according to my son, his mom is so on fleek. Look it up. It is a compliment. Thank you.
What does on fleek mean to you, Peter Sokolowski and Merriam-Webster?
I mean, this was an amazing phenomenon because it was a Vine video from 2014. And it was a young woman who was basically saying, my eyebrows are on fleek. In other words, they look great. They look ready. They look ready for going out and being in public. And so, yes, it's a compliment. It's a funny kind of way and a very 21st century kind of way for a term to be born. In other words, with a viral video and what might have been an idiolect, some kind of idiosyncratic language on the part of that young woman. Maybe her friends also used that term, but it's a way that the language spreads. You know, language has always worked the same way, which is that if you and I agree on the way a word sounds and the way it is used, then we continue without noticing it. But if something is new, we all notice the new term, right? We all notice and say, hey, what does that mean? In this case, it was a viral video that started the whole thing. And it is possible that it will be entered in the dictionary. We have entered it as a word we're watching. We have these kind of like words that are out there that we're paying attention to, that we're watching, and we're watching year over year to see if they have increased usage.
Okay, on fleek might make it into the major leagues of the dictionary. It's a word to watch. Okay, so you were telling me, I was asking you what a word needs to get into the dictionary. You said widespread use. Mm-hmm. You said you make an educated guess about staying power.
Yeah.
And then it sounded like you were about to tell me one more thing.
Yeah, there's a third criterion, and it may seem a little arcane, but hey, we're the dictionary. So widespread use, long-term use, and finally, meaningful use. And that might sound odd, but there are words that we have in the language that that aren't used to carry meaning. And think of supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. That satisfies the first two criteria. It's got widespread use and long-term use. But I don't think we all agree on exactly what it means. And it's really just a fun word to say. But there are more serious examples of this. A lot of people cite a very long word as being maybe the longest word in the dictionary, anti-disestablishmentarianism.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a word that is so often cited as being the longest word in people people's dictionaries people ask us about it. But the fact is, it's not in our dictionary because it's usually only used to cite itself. They're just saying, well, it basically just means a long word. And anti-disestablishmentarianism used in a historical context, meaning, against opposition to the establishment of the Church of England as the national religion in Britain. I think that's the actual definition of anti-disestablishmentarianism. But it's almost never used that way, so we don't put it in our dictionary.
Wow, so it had a meaning, obviously, but it's not being used enough to qualify for Merriam-Webster anymore.
Right. If it's used just by one writer, if it's an idiosyncratic use or what we call a nonce use, used, you know, just by one writer in one place. I mean, there, for example, about 10 years ago, there was a word used frequently in the New Yorker magazine, Christianism, to parallel with Islamist and Islamism. And it was used all the time in very serious contexts, but it was always sort of one writer, one periodical. And it's a word we're watching for sure, but it's not a word that has caught on in the broadest possible way.
Let's talk about some more words with Merriam-Webster's editor-at-large, Peter Sokolowski. The words trending on Merriam-Webster.com, you told us about abhorrent. Another is oleaginous, which I only realized because you told us about that I had it wrong. I thought oleaginous meant gelatinous, and it doesn't. But what is oleaginous, and why are people looking that up?
Well, it basically means oily, it's a great word.
It
and
is.
It comes from, you know, the Latin word meant olive tree. So olea meant olive tree in Latin, and that's an interesting sort of oily, and olive oil is really where it comes from. It was, in this case, in May, it was used in a column by George Will in the Washington Post. And sometimes words that are looked up frequently are triggered by the journalists, by people who use these words in their articles or headlines. And in this case, he was describing Vice President Mike Pence with the word oleaginous. And George Will is a very conservative writer, and that particular article got a lot of attention, and people were forwarding it and sharing it and commenting upon it. But ultimately, George Will is also a writer who uses a very wide vocabulary and very varied words. And this is one of the words he put into that column.
I'm glad you brought up a reference to Mike Pence, because the words we use to describe the world can be political. And sometimes Merriam-Webster gets accused of being political. So after Kellyanne Conway talked about alternative facts, Merriam-Webster tweeted, in contemporary use, fact is understood to refer to something with actual existence. What did Merriam-Webster mean by that, and were you being political?
Well, we stick to the words. So the fact is, because of the data, because we know which words are being looked up in real time, we saw something remarkable that day, which is that the word fact, which is a very basic kind of elementary word in English, one that we had never seen spike in our data, it spiked to number one. People really were essentially asking a question of the dictionary. And it's true that the dictionary calls balls and strikes on things like spelling and meaning. And so when a word is in the news, and if that word is in a political context or not, whether it's used, for example, after a mistake at the Oscars or following a Super Bowl game. But in this case, it was a political context. But the word was looked up. And when we see that data, when we see that there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people looking up this word in the space of a very short amount of time, we feel like essentially people are coming to the dictionary with a question and we have an answer. And in that case, that was a tweet that was just simply citing the definition of the word. And of course, there's some wit to it. Of course, this is Twitter, after all. There's some kind of notion of what a subtweet is, that is to say, commenting on the broader stories of the day. But I would emphasize that in every case like that, people, if they found it funny or entertaining, or that we were somehow correcting Kellyanne Conway, that, you know, is essentially not what we're doing. And what we are doing is presenting the dictionary definition as it is written in our dictionary, and if people are looking it up, we assume that that's what they're after. And you know, when the question is spelling, for example, President Trump notoriously misspells things in his tweets. Again, we see Well, yes, but more substantially, a word like unprecedented, mm-hmm. or a word like heal, H-E-A-L is what he intended, and he used two E's, I think. And so, it sent this spike in our data, which shows a lot of things. It shows that people are paying attention. It shows that people care. It shows that words matter. And so, ultimately, we stick to the words. We're commenting on the words. We're not commenting on the politics. But the thing is, when a prominent person uses language in a remarkable way, that is to say, in a way that contradicts what is accepted and used and traditional usage that is reported in the dictionary, then we will comment on that because it raises obvious lexical questions.
So without being political, then, are you saying that you think, as a lexicographer, that the Trump administration is changing the dictionary or is affecting our language?
Well, they certainly are affecting the discourse. You know, I mean, the whole, it seems like the whole culture is riveted to this political story, for sure. At the same time, we do believe that words matter. And the fact that all of our traffic shows that people are paying attention to the news, I think is a really gratifying and important thing for everybody. You know, for democracy, for all kinds of politics of every side. We know that people look up words in the dictionary to find an objective and neutral arbiter of the language. And maybe that's a problem in this moment, that there are alternative facts and fake news, and people are accused of having bias in all these different ways. And yet the dictionary has always, in a sense, represented this sort of neutral arbiter. And I'm very happy that people continue to come to us with that kind of question. It does seem more urgent now, and it maybe seems faster now, but those are artifacts of social media, not so much of the dictionary. In other words, I think the dictionary has always served this role, but now we have the data to prove it.
Separate from the Trump administration, I do notice words having changing political contexts to them, uses. I notice the term social justice warrior anymore. It seems like I hear that used more as an insult than otherwise. Is that right? And is that a change?
Well, yeah, it's interesting, but this is almost too fast for us to record at the moment.
Yeah.
In other words, you're absolutely right. And what we have to do is kind of step back and look in that rearview mirror and watch for this change. If a title or a name like that sort of switches on itself, turns on itself, and becomes sort of the opposite of what it plainly means in its component parts, then we would have to define it in a second way. We'd have to add that second definition. But at the moment, of course, social justice warrior, we would consider it to be self-evident in-house. That's the term, self-explanatory, in other words. Compound words like that frequently are not defined in the dictionary because you can sort of figure it out by adding them together. And just to give you an example, cattle ranch is not defined in the dictionary. You can look up cattle and look up ranch. But dude ranch is defined in the dictionary because nothing about those two words would explain to you that it's a place that city people go to have a country life experience, you know. So that's how we draw the line. We draw the line according to what is self-explanatory or not.
In the case of social justice warrior, I had assumed that this changing use is cultural conservatives being sarcastic about a term that liberals embraced in the first place.
You may be right. That's my understanding, too. You may be exactly right. But again, that is the way that it's always worked. There are names that have been sort of reclaimed. A term like gay, for example, or queer, which is no longer just the epithet, just the insult. It's been reclaimed by those groups. And that's another way that the language operates, that it can turn on itself.
Yeah, and turning fast, you brought up the terms like queer. I have the impression that identity terms are changing faster than ever. LGBTQIA and Latinx, POC is very common now for people of color. I mean, how does the language absorb change that fast?
Well, English has always been a mongrel language, and we've always absorbed these words. The difference is today, of course, communication is faster. You know, I mean, humans still process language in the same way. We still learn language in the same way. And you know, if you've ever tried to learn a foreign language, it's taxing. It's difficult. It's a hard thing to do. Adding a new word to English used to take decades. decades, you know, because communication was slower. And now it moves much more quickly. A good example is the word blog, which I think we added to the dictionary maybe 4 years after it was coined. But, you know, to add some perspective, that also happened for the word AIDS in the 1980s, about 4 years after it was coined. And that's because it was clear that this word was in the news and it was here to stay. And so what we are going to watch for with the speed of social media is to see which words are really here to stay and are going to stick around for long enough. You know, the dictionary, you know, we are ultimately a kind of a, you know, the work of human hands. We have to observe the language in real time, create a definition, and seek the etymology, which is sometimes opaque, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's easy to find another word, sometimes it's not. And so research is required, and then we can present that to the public. What's great about the online dictionary is there's no longer any space limitations, so we can add as many words as we possibly can.
I remember my parents were confused that Oriental was no longer acceptable. And when you have terms, especially human identity terms, changing this fast, some people can feel alienated by not being up on the language and judged for that.
Yeah. And that's a terrible feeling. At the same time, you know this, we are all judged always by the way we present ourselves in words, whether it's a misspelling or a mispronunciation or, for example, a regional pronunciation that may be judged in one way or another as being different. You may be judged as having, for example, less formal education. You may be judged as being from a different country. There's all kinds of judgments that we always assess. And so language is very difficult and intricate in that way. And here's the other thing. It's the final socially accepted prejudice. Somebody makes a spelling error on Twitter, you can go to town making fun of them. And what are you essentially saying? You're saying, well, I believe that I am smarter than you because you misspelled a word. And yet we also know that English spelling is almost arbitrary. You know, English spelling is incredibly difficult and not phonetic. And so the fact is, all you're saying, if you know the correct spelling of a word, is that you know the set of rules that the culture has agreed upon that is the correct spelling of a word. And you like showing that to others who agree with that spelling or who have studied that kind of material,
Peter,
to create us and them.
Yes, I have time for one more current word controversy. Mm-hmm. They and them as a gender-neutral pronoun, why does that upset so many people?
Well, you know, that for a couple hundred years, people have been using he or the masculine pronoun as the gender-neutral pronoun, the singular pronoun. What we call the singular they has, in fact, always been grammatical in English. It's always been used in English. It's used in Chaucer and Shakespeare and all the earlier writings. The problem with English is it's a 1,000-year-old language, but the grammars of the language are only about 250 years old. And so sometimes what we find is the square peg of the English language, as it's spoken naturally, was sort of fitted into the round hole of Latin grammar. And this is, you know, this is one of the reasons that there are examples like you can't end a sentence with a preposition or you can't split an infinitive. All of these are actually not English grammar rules. They are style guides from mostly the 18th century. And it's maybe time that we recognize that natural usage can actually be the grammar guide as well.
The editor-at-large of Merriam-Webster, Peter Sokolowski, has no problem with they and them as a gender-neutral pronoun to refer to a person. Let's do this again. This is fascinating, Peter. Thanks so much.
It's a treat. Thank you.
I didn't even get a chance to ask you about Laurel versus Yanny, but that's its own, its own word controversy. But Peter Sokolowski, I want to let people know that you're in D.C. this week pronouncing for the Scripps Spelling Bee. You pronounce for the spellers.
Well, I actually at the Bee, I mostly do color commentary on Twitter because they have wonderful pronouncers here at the Bee, including some colleagues of mine. I do pronounce for lots of bees, but not this one. This is the big stage.
Okay, you can check out the Spelling Bee Finals live on ESPN tomorrow night, 5:30 Pacific time. Peter, thanks a lot for this.
Thank you.